Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Supreme Court's decision in McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission that, according to an impassioned dissent from Justice Stephen Breyer, eviscerates our nation's campaign finance laws. Robert Weissman, the president of Public Citizen, joins us to discuss the ruling that expands the conservative majority on the Supreme Court's doctrine that money equals free speech, removing a limit of $123,000 to the point where now a wealthy individual can write a single check for $5.9 million to a candidate, political party, or political committee. Since there are only a few hundred people in America who will benefit from this ruling, we'll examine what it means for the rest of us. Then we'll look into the hypocrisy on display in a House hearing where Republican champions of deregulation who cut the budget for the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration by 10% in 2014, castigated the new female head of GM for lax oversight of safety in the manufacture of their cars, which resulted in 12 deaths from a faulty ignition switch that could have cost $1 to replace. Nicholas Freudenberg, a distinguished professor of public health at City University of New York and Hunter College, and the author of Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health, joins us to discuss the capture by corporations of government oversight over public health and safety by what he calls the corporate consumption complex. Then finally, we'll go to Israel to speak with the former spokesman for Shimon Peres, Gideon Levy, who is a columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. With the U.S.-brokered Israeli-Palestinian peace talks faltering, we will discuss the apparent inclusion of Jonathan Pollard, the American convicted of spying for Israel, as a bargaining chip in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, which has in turn prompted Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to ask for reciprocal concessions. And joining us now is Robert Weissman, who's the president of Public Citizen and an expert on economic, healthcare, trade and globalization, intellectual property and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibility. He has written extensively on corporate accountability, access to medicines, corporate influence over the political process, the World Trade Organization, and regulations of the financial markets. He's worked to lower pharmacy prices for AIDS victims and others in the developing world, and his top priorities include climate change, healthcare reform, financial regulation, and campaign finance reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Weissman.
It's great to be with you.
And the decision today from the Supreme Court striking down what's left of campaign finance laws in this country, it's left Justice Stephen Breyer, who made a very passionate dissent, which he read in an unusual way. He read the dissent from the bench, saying that this ruling eviscerates campaign rules in this country. Apart from what Chief Justice Roberts may be saying about why he's doing that, why do you think he's doing it?
This is a ruling that establishes plutocrat rights. The practical meaning of this is that super rich people can now write a single check for $5.9 million or perhaps infinitely into infinity to fund directly candidates, political parties, and political committees. There are really only a few hundred people in the country who might plausibly do that. And this is a decision that seeks to and will advance their interests at the very obvious expense of the rest of us.
But again, I'm trying to understand, you can dress this up in whatever legal nicety you want, but I'm trying to understand what the thinking of this conservative majority on the court is. You know, sort of cutting through the legalese, what kind of an America do they want?
Well, you know, they're sort of willfully ignorant of how campaign spending works, at least that's the generous interpretation, and they have this idea of the First Amendment, which it means that people who have the ability should be able to spend whatever they want to influence the way elections go. So, you know, what kind of America is that? Well, in their view, that, at least as they describe it in their writings, that's an America that realizes the values of the founders, that makes sure the First Amendment is respected and democracy works. I mean, I think there's about five people who think that way. They happen to all sit on the Supreme Court. Maybe there's a few others, but pretty much every, you know, the vast majority of people in the country understand that when you give the super rich and corporations the ability to fund and dominate the funding of our elections, They're going to control both who gets elected, who runs, and what kind of policies we get out of Congress, what kind of policies we get from the president, what we get out of the state legislature. In fact, that's what we're going to get. So, you know, I can't mind read for the court majority. I don't know if they mean what they say. If they do, it's unbelievably naive and theoretical. But in any case, I have a high degree of certainty about what it's going to mean in practice. And it's really a dark day for this country.
Well, I'm just struggling with trying to understand it, Robert Weissman, and trying also to understand what, in any way, whether there's any evidence that somehow the First Amendment rights of Americans are being, of rich Americans are being abridged. That's the part that I don't understand. What evidence is there that the First Amendment rights of the rich and the super rich are being abridged? I thought, if anything, they had, because of their enormous wealth, they could purchase more speech than the average citizen. So the opposite seems to be true to me.
Yeah, well, won't be it for me to make the case in the Supreme Court. The limits before today were that an individual could only give around $125,000 directly to candidates, parties, and political committees. And you had a guy, Sean McCutcheon, he said, look, I want to do more than that. I want to spend more, and this is an infringement of my First Amendment rights. And the court said, yeah, absolutely, you're right. And they said, we have to weigh against that the interest of the public. Is there any countervailing public interest in maintaining the existing restrictions at this level around $125,000? And the short answer from the court was no. There's no legitimate interest. Why? Because the only thing the court counts as a legitimate countervailing interest is, does this make bribery more or less likely? Well, actually, it does make bribery more likely, but it doesn't make it more likely in a legal sense. It doesn't authorize anyone to do bribery more than they're authorized to do it now. So the court said, look, there's not really any countervailing interest, and we're striking down these existing limits. Now, pretty much everybody else in the country, as I said, understands that we have an interest in political equality. We have an interest in corruption and preventing corruption that goes way beyond anything like just dealing with quid pro quo bribery. And we also have an interest, a First Amendment interest, in making sure that, as you say, all of us have a right to speak, not just the rights that are attached to those who have the giant megaphone provided by $5.9 million campaign contributions.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Weissman, who's the president of Public Citizen and an expert on economics, healthcare, trade and globalization, intellectual property and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibility. His top priorities include climate change, healthcare reform, financial regulation and campaign finance reform. And we're talking about the decision that came out today from the Supreme Court in the case McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission, that has struck down what remaining campaign finance rules exist following, of course, the Citizens United decision, which has clearly had manifest and apparent consequences, which are unbelievably clear. And yet the swing vote, Justice Kennedy, going back to Citizens United, he somehow thought that that ruling would be mitigated by the fact that there'd be transparency. And then shortly after that ruling, there was an attempt to pass the Disclose Act in the Congress, which the Republicans shut down. And instead of there being transparency, in other words, everybody that gives money would have to be identified, the reverse is happening through these so-called social welfare nonprofits, the 501c4s, where unlimited amounts of dark money are pouring in and nobody knows who's giving that money and who's buying that political access. So I hate to put you in this position, and I know you're uncomfortable trying to figure out what the Supreme Court or the conservatives on the Supreme Court are thinking. But at this point, is there any way to reach these people and say, look, you know, it hasn't worked out the way Citizens United hasn't worked out the way you said it was. So, you know, why dig the hole deeper?
Yeah, well, I mean, the answer is no. You know, we tried. We filed an amicus brief in this case. We thought that there was a chance that Chief Justice Roberts would side to uphold the existing limits, which would have made five votes. We thought that when the case was going forward, the oral argument where the parties speak before the court went poorly, and I think people pretty much expected after that oral argument that it was going to come out more or less the way it did today. And, you know, there are a few remaining campaign finance restrictions still in place, and every single one of those is in jeopardy with this court. What are we going to do going forward? Well, I should say first thing is that people are responding across the country today with demonstrations in 38 states across the country, and including in Los Angeles. There's demonstrations planned tonight in downtown L.A. and in Pasadena, I think in Santa Barbara, and elsewhere. People interested in that can go to overturnmccutcheon.org and get information about it. But what we're really going to need to, and what those demonstrations are doing, is calling for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, now overturn McCutcheon, and restore our democracy. We're going to have to sweep away all of this Supreme Court jurisprudence and take this decision out of the hands of this 5-vote majority on the court and say, look, we the people intend to reassert our control. Anything short of that, I think, is going to fall really short, and we're going to have a democracy that's being choked by the money interests, by the super rich and the giant corporations.
But one of the reasons we have this Supreme Court majority of these extremely conservative men, and arguably they may be the only 5 men on the planet who don't seem to understand that the more rights you give to the super rich, the more they control our politics. If you make our politics about money, then he who has the most money owns the most politics. It's not really hard to figure out. So I'm struggling to try and figure out now whether we should stop pretending that this is about the law and the majesty of the law, and start recognizing that we may well have Republican political operatives here on our Supreme Court. And it's time for people to recognize that they get their majority because people don't vote in their interests, and sufficient people don't vote. We're told now that the Republicans are going to take over the Senate. The Senate's going to be, after November, is going to be run by Mitch McConnell, who's being funded by the Koch brothers. So what is happening with how do you get the American people to wake up and recognize the direct connection between participating in elections and getting the kind of people on the Supreme Court that will actually operate in the interests of the average American as opposed in the interests of millionaires and billionaires?
Well, you know, what we do to increase participation rates in this country is a big question. Of course, this very same court has made it dramatically more difficult for people to vote, including especially through the recent decision in the Shelby County case, eviscerating the longstanding Voting Rights Act. But I think, you know, I think people do broadly understand that there is far too much influence for big money in the political process. I mean, when you see the poll data, question after question, 80-90% of people think that corporations and the super wealthy have too much influence in Washington, too much influence in their state houses. So people really do get this. What we have to do is now not just get it and, you know, and be sad about it and stand aside and be disempowered, but mobilize, get in the streets, and demand change. I think people are starting to do that, and when we have no choice but to do that at a much grander scale than we've done so far. And when we do, we are the majority. This is really goes beyond party. You know, and the people across the country, Republicans and Democrats, Independents, Greens, whatever, everybody pretty much has the same view about this. So if we all can actually mobilize to assert ourselves, we still do have the tools available to make a difference. Now, it is completely correct that, particularly in Washington, the Republican Party has become the party of no when it comes to anything relating to campaign finance reform. It's a major shift in the last 10 years, particularly in the Senate, where Mitch McConnell has clamped down on all the Republicans who were longtime supporters of campaign finance restrictions, including, for example, John McCain, for whom McCain-Feingold was named, no longer able to support any practical measures. So we're going to have to give, you know, we have to have more organizing, more grassroots pressure across the country to offset the top-down pressure being exerted by people like Mitch McConnell.
But it does seem to me, Robert Weissman, that this is, I mean, this may be too cynical for some people, but it seems to me that this might well be the Republican Party's response to their demographic disadvantage, in as much as the country's changing, there are fewer and fewer white men and more minorities are coming of age, and not enough of them are signing up to vote, but still the numbers would indicate that the demographics are changing, and we know that there's a certain atavism and fear on the part of Republicans that they are going to become, or the white man is going to become the minority in this country, and that's the demographics indicate that is the case. And rather than fight on a level playing field, it would seem that what's going on here is that they are trying to make up for what they perceive as an electoral disadvantage by being able to spend unlimited amounts of money and have the legal right to suppress the vote, as you mentioned, in overturning the important pre-clearance part of the Voting Rights Act that just happened recently. That, again, makes me wonder whether we're dealing with political operatives here as opposed to jurists. And
I don't think there's anything cynical about that at all. I mean, you don't, whether or not, you know, the five members of the court are thinking that, I think that's very, almost explicitly, the objective of, you know, Republican Party leaders and the, you know, the consortium of Koch brother-funded think tanks, operative organizations, the Chamber of Commerce, and so on. That's exactly the program. Limit the pool of voters, discourage them from voting through massive negative, you know, discourage big chunks of the voting population from voting altogether through massive negative advertising. Empower the super rich and the corporations to spend unlimited amounts to control the election process and try to keep control. That's their broad anti-democratic agenda, full stop. And it's intensified, exactly as you say, you know, against the backdrop of things, at least the more far-sighted than people like Karl Rove see happening, which is, is of course very evident, California and elsewhere, the demographic shifts you're talking about. Yes, they know they've got to deal with that, and this is their program. Make it harder for people to vote and give more power to the rich and corporations over the electoral process.
So just in closing then, Robert Weissman, if we are in the new Gilded Age and this is so clearly and so brazenly a, you know, fealty towards plutocrats and an insult to the average citizen, do you think the average citizen's going to feel sufficiently insulted to do something? I mean, one of the things that's happening around the world is people are taking to the main squares, whether it's in Kiev or in Tahrir Square or in Spain or in Greece or in Turkey, and the universal protest is dignity. That's what people feel. They feel that the government has taken away their dignity. And I don't see a difference here. I think that there should be indignation on the part of the average American that their dignity is being insulted because their right to vote is being basically insulted by this idea that, we're going to allow the wealthy to buy more votes than you have, and we're going to figure out a way to discourage you from voting. And if we can't do that, we'll stop you from voting with all of these mendacious manipulations that can be done via voter suppression. So do you think that maybe we're going to have our town squares occupied at some point in the future, as is happening around the world?
Well, I sure hope so. I mean, we're working to help achieve that. I do think it's going to happen. This is a country that in many ways has dramatically more freedoms than the places you're referencing. But we also have systems of control and disenfranchisement and disempowerment that are far more sophisticated than military clampdown. So that's the big challenge. We have these freedoms, but we have to exercise them. I think that is going to happen. I think Citizens United started a movement, and I think this decision today in McCutcheon is going to make it dramatically more powerful. And we're going to see across this nation a grassroots movement that is really deep, that has the capacity to stay in it for the long haul and both win a constitutional amendment to overturn these decisions and restore our democracy, but more fundamentally even than that, take control and insist that the country has to work for regular people, not just for the super rich, not just for the Koch brothers and their friends, not just for the giant corporations.
Well, Robert Weisman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's great to be with you. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Weisman, who's a president of Public Citizen and an expert on economics, healthcare, trade and globalization, intellectual property and regulatory policy. His top priorities include climate change, healthcare reform, financial regulation and campaign finance reform. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the capture by corporations of government oversight over public health and safety by the corporate consumption complex.
It's the money.
Ask the girl what she wanted to be. She said, baby, can't you see? I want to be famous, a star of the screen. But you can do something in between. Maybe you can drive my car. Yes, I'm going.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nicholas Freudenberg, who's a distinguished professor of public health at City University of New York and Hunter College, and the author of a new book, Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Freudenberg.
Thanks for having me.
And clearly, with these hearings that just took place on Capitol Hill, with the new head of General Motors being raked over the coals, largely by Republican congressmen who have up until now not proven themselves to be great stewards of public health and certainly great watchdogs of corporate America. So let's start with that. I mean, for all the posturing, there's no question that GM, at least 12 people died for a part that cost a dollar. And so many of these people that died were young teenage women, from what I can tell. There's no question that's an abomination. But what was your sense of the theater on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think theater is the right word. That it seems to be the damage control advice of the day. When you have a problem like this, you apologize profusely and say things will be different in the future. But you do that after the problem is revealed to the public, not when you first know about it. And I think the underlying problem is really our government's ambivalence about regulation. And I think the intent of the regulatory legislation for both the auto safety industry passed in 1966, but also we could look at regulation of the food industry and other industries, was to protect public health. But I think increasingly, especially after the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980 and his dictum that government was the problem, not the solution, there's been a notion that regulators ought to compromise between protecting public health and protecting profit. And that's really a recipe for disaster. And I think we're seeing one more example of that disaster in the latest General Motors story.
But I'm in referring, though, as I did to the congressmen, the Republicans in particular, who were scolding the new head of GM. My sense is that these people were being absolute abject hypocrites because they are the big deregulators. That's their mantra.
Exactly. They're reaping what they've sown in a very tragic way. And I think for example, the National Highway Safety and Transportation Administration, which is the government agency known as NHTSA that is responsible for enforcing these laws, got 10% less than they'd asked for in fiscal year 2014. So the time to have insisted on this was when funding requests came up for these agencies. And in addition, The Congress, and particularly the Republican majority in the House of Representatives, has been systematically reducing funding for regulation, and inevitably that will lead to preventable deaths and preventable illnesses.
So, Nicholas Freudenberg, in your new book, Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health, you talk about a corporate consumption complex. Obviously, we've heard of the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex, the intelligence-industrial complex. Now we have the corporate consumption complex. So explain it.
Sure. I'm proposing that that's the network of consumer corporations, multinational global consumer corporations, their trade associations, their the banks and investment funds that provide financing, the advertising agencies, and the elected officials, scientists, and journalists they pay for. And the argument I make in the book is that this corporate consumption complex promotes what I call hyperconsumption, health habits, lifestyles that put people at risk of premature death, preventable illness and injury. And they promote hyperconsumption because that increases their bottom line, increases their profits, but at the expense of well-being. And the most serious health problems facing this nation today are chronic diseases and injuries. And in large part, I argue in the book, that these health problems that are putting such a stress on our healthcare system are the result of the business and political practices of the corporate consumption complex. The specific industries I profile in my book are the alcohol industry, the food industry, the automobile industry, the firearm industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and the tobacco industry.
Again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Freudenberg, who's a distinguished professor of public health at City University of New York and Hunter College, and the author of the new book, Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. Well, coincidentally, Nicholas, preceding you on today's program is the head of Public Citizen, Robert Weissman. We're talking about the latest Supreme Court decision eviscerating what's left of campaign finance rules in this country. And, of course, Public Citizen was founded, ironically, by General Motors, in as much as they went after the messenger, who was an obscure consumer crusader named Ralph Nader, who in 1965 published a book, Unsafe at Any Speed. And rather than address the problem with the Chevrolet Corvair, General Motors sicked a bunch of private detectives and tried to, you know, kill the messenger, if you will. In Ralph Nader, he was able to sue and get an enormous penalty out of General Motors, which he then invested in Public Citizen, which is surviving to this day and doing important work. And in the conversation preceding this one, we talked about the idea that the Supreme Court is now controlled by a majority of conservatives and corporatists who are empowering millionaires and billionaires at the expense of ordinary citizens. But it seems to me the same contempt, if you accept that idea, that in effect this ruling McCutcheon indicates a kind of contempt for the average American because they think that rich people have more rights than ordinary people. If there is that same contempt for citizens, it would seem the logical extension would be that there's the same contempt for consumers.
Yes, and I think it's striking that how similar the facts of GM's current problems with the cobalt are to the problems in 1965 with the Corvair that Ralph Nader exposed. And you wonder what GM has learned from that incident, or maybe you wonder about the ground rules that enable corporations to put profit above human life. But I think the lesson that I take from the book, where I look at, you know, really the last century of activism around public health, is that there have been periods in U.S. history where social movements and reformers and health professionals and researchers have joined together to really change the balance of power between the public sector and government and between corporations. And I think we're now beginning in the mid-1970s. I talk about the much-discussed Powell memo that really laid out an agenda for business to win back the rights that Ralph Nader and others had won through consumer legislation and environmental protection. And I think we're seeing what I hope will be the tail end of that pendulum swing of business, you know, winning influence in our political system, on the Supreme Court, as you said, in Congress, and that by looking for the links between people working to improve our food supply, to improve the safety of our autos, to further reduce promotion of tobacco, we can create a social movement for health and equity that will be able to redraw these balances between government and market.
But of course, Nicholas Freudenberg, when the Supreme Court makes these reactionary rulings, as they've done with McCutcheon, it makes it so much more difficult to overturn it. In the case of Citizens United and McCutcheon, you now need a constitutional amendment, which is a big, heavy lift. And
yes, but the lesson, the counterexample I cite, is that the Supreme Court and the federal courts follow rather than lead public opinion. And some of the recent decisions on gay marriage, I think, show that mobilizing and organizing changes the nature of the debate. And it might unfortunately take a decade or two decades, but the history of this country is people joining together and changing those ground rules. So that has to be the priority for today, difficult as it seems, you know, at this moment in time, especially around the Supreme Court, which is so pro-corporate in its leanings.
So, Nicholas Freudenberg, let's get into that, the corporate culture that you talk about, that would basically save the corporation $1 knowing that there's a defective ignition switch on an automobile that they're producing and have produced for decades that has killed at least 12 people. You know, we're talking about $12 for, you know, equals 12 lives. It's pretty hard to swallow, but there is a sort of a banality of evil here. You know, you've got the obvious fact that since Nader, the vehicle death rate in the United States has fallen from 25.9 per 100,000 people in 1966 to 10.8 per 100,000 in 2012. And so we know that Nader's and safety has saved lives. And if there was more focus on it, there'd be more lives saved. But
apparently, and we also know that other countries have achieved much better, have achieved even bigger reductions. And so we know that if we were to make it a priority, we could do much better than we've done, even better.
Well, excuse me. Well, I have a friend who worked for General Motors for quite a while, and he was telling me that the corporate culture is such that the engineers don't have much clout, whereas the accountants do. And the bean counters in headquarters have the real power. And that even out at the test track, when they're testing automobiles, the engineers are kind of told in a kind of wink and a nod, you know, to pass it. So don't cause us any trouble, don't cause us any delays, don't cause us any more costs. Just have the vehicle pass the test. What explains that kind of corporate culture? I imagine it's pretty simple, right? If you rock the boat, you lose your job.
And I think in Lethal But Legal, I discuss some of the changes in the global economy that have contributed to this mentality. One is certainly short-termism. You know, the notion that corporate managers need to bring returns on investment not just over the long run, but every quarter, every year. And that really creates a climate and culture of not wanting to find out if there's a problem because you might lose your job before that happens. And I think also the consolidation of so many industries, including the automobile industry, means there's less competition and therefore less paying attention to the areas that might make a difference, and also more money as there are fewer bigger corporations to spend on advertising and product development rather than focusing on safety. But I think where there are governments that insist that it's their responsibility and mandate to protect public health, then industry wouldn't be allowed to get away with these things. So we need to be working on a few different fronts, but including those, really restoring the visible hand of government in our public life, that only government has the mandate and the authority and the resources to protect public health. And when Congress or other government bodies undermine that mandate and don't provide the resources to allow it to do it, then we see preventable deaths, as in this GM case.
Well, of course, the irony is, of course, now is that Mary Barra of GM, who was apologizing profusely to the Congress, who were grandstanding and were a bunch of hypocrites, at least to my mind, the Republicans certainly were. Nevertheless, it's pretty clear, isn't it, that this saving $12 or $13 costing the lives of those mostly young teenage drivers is going to cost them an awful lot more in the long run, and I imagine it's not doing their product line much good after they've been bailed out by the government, and they appear to have made something of a turnaround, and she herself is being used as a kind of symbol of corporate modernization, at least in terms of the boardroom. So
yes, and this isn't the first time that we've seen this short-sightedness on the part of the automobile industry. They're putting all their eggs in the sports utility vehicle basket in the late 1990s, a vehicle that was far more profitable, 10 to 12 times as profitable as sedans, but far more dangerous, far more polluting. And yet they promoted them heavily. They spent, the big three spent $9 billion advertising SUVs in the late 1990s. And as they became to dominate the market and as gasoline prices went up, that market collapsed. And their poor judgment in putting all their investment in the profitable but not sustainable SUVs really led to the need for this government bailout during the economic crisis. So it's not the first time that they've made short-sighted calculations. And part of the reason they continue to be able to do that is that too often our government and our society allows corporations to externalize the costs of their mistakes, to charge them to the victims of those conditions or to taxpayers or to the government. And we need to be looking for policy levers that will allow us to return those costs to the producer of them. And we've seen, at least here in the United States, that forcing the tobacco industry to compensate states for caring for the for people with tobacco-related illnesses served as a warning message and helped the federal government win authority to regulate tobacco more closely. So we need to see that same returning costs. Another strategy that I think is important is to hold corporate executives criminally liable when they deliberately withhold information from regulatory agencies, and those and that withholding results in injuries and deaths. That it's not enough simply to fine them, but in anybody else who took an action that led to injury or death knowingly would be prosecuted for that, and we need to see that happen with corporations as well.
Well, just in closing, Nicholas Freudenberg, there is out here in California a new car maker, Elon Musk, and his Tesla wins all the prizes by reviewers as the best car on the road, and it's made in California. It's a whole different business plan. They don't have dealerships, etc. He's brought an awful lot of new thinking to the whole automobile world, not the least of which, of course, that the car doesn't pollute. It's an electric car. And mind you, the cost of the batteries is really what is making it prohibitive, but they say that eventually they'll bring those down. But do you think he's going to survive? In other words, if these people can't cure themselves, will the marketplace cure them by turning them into the dinosaurs that they are?
Well, I'm not confident that the marketplace by itself is the solution. And certainly, I think we need better models of cars. We need, hybrid and electric and other kinds of cars. But the real solution, both for economic reasons and particularly for environmental and sustainability reasons, is to develop much more robust public transportation systems. And that requires a publicly supported infrastructure. And many other countries have invested in a public transportation system. It brings benefits to business. It brings benefits to the population. It has health and environmental benefits. So I think the challenge of this part of the 21st century is really to restore a public role in protecting the commons and in coming up with decisions that have as their primary goal improving human well-being, not enhancing corporate profitability. And we have a ways to go to achieve such a political system.
Well, Nicholas Freudenberg, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
Again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Freudenberg, who's a distinguished professor of public health at City University of New York and Hunter College, and the author of the new book, Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to Israel to look into the inclusion of Jonathan Pollard as a bargaining chip in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Israel is Gideon Levy, who is an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the former spokesman for Shimon Peres, and Gideon Levy writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza for over the last 25 years, and his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gideon Levy.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
And we were told just a day or so ago that these endless and agonizing peace talks between Israel and Palestine have reached a point now where Secretary of State Kerry may have to release Jonathan Pollard, the American who spied for Israel, from prison. And that was supposedly a bargaining chip in this negotiation. But now we're being whipsawed again, and this time it appears to be the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has abruptly signed a whole bunch of international treaties, which apparently both the U.S. and the Israelis seem to think are going to sink the deal. So it's almost like a competition between which side can torpedo the deal first. Is that a way to look at it?
Not necessarily, because all the parties, the Americans, the Palestinians, and the Israelis, are interested in the continuous of this masquerade, which is called the peace process. Each of them for its own reasons, but the interest is quite common. And not always a very genuine interest. In many cases, it's also a personal interest, but or a surviving interest, but they're all interested in continuing. What happened is that when the deal was almost be signed, Abbas rightly so said, why do the Israelis get such a candy, such a precious chip for the Israelis, like the release of Jonathan Porat, and I don't get anything? And he came up with new requirements, mainly to release some big names, some Palestinian big names, as a balance to the release of Jonathan Porat. And this created a whole turmoil. And now we stand where we stand, but I'm not sure it's final. I think that the coming days there will be more efforts to save this process.
But why then is Jonathan Pollard so important? If he's so important to Israel that the Palestinians feel that they need reciprocity, let's begin with that big question. What is it about Pollard that is so important to Israel?
They made Pollard as the idol of the right-wingers in Israel. And it was almost the only way for Benjamin Netanyahu to try to market any kind of deal, because exactly those who oppose any kind of deal are the biggest supporters of Pollard. And this put them in a very embarrassing situation, because on one hand, they are screaming for years release Jonathan Pollard. On the other hand, they are the most, the harshest opposition for any kind of deal with the Palestinians. So Netanyahu thought he can challenge them, and he thought that the chip of Pollard will really finally make him pass anything he wants, which might still be the case. Pollard is a very artificial creation, very artificial outcome of some kind of spins and public campaigns, because I think most of the Israelis couldn't care less about him. But he became an idol, and now he became a very precious chip.
Well, surely Gideon Levy, Prime Minister Netanyahu, does have a problem, doesn't he, holding his coalition together. They're dead against peace talks. They don't want a settlement. They want to keep annexing as much of the Palestinian territory as they can. Nobody, at least to my mind, is quite sure what their end game is here. But it's pretty clear that they're very hostile to the so-called peace process, which you have, I think, rightly described as a masquerade. So is it possible? I mean, if Netanyahu can pull it off with a little trick like Pollard, that's pretty amazing to my mind. But is there any way, if this government were to collapse, that Netanyahu could put together a left-wing coalition to continue? Or we know that it's not exactly, he's never been enthusiastic about this process to begin with, has he?
And that's exactly the problem. Would Netanyahu really believe in this process? Would Netanyahu really believe in peace with the Palestinians? Would Netanyahu really believe in the Palestinians? Then he could pass whatever he wants. He's using all those excuses just to break away from a decision, claiming that he will lose his government, that he will lose his coalition. First of all, his coalition is more solid than it seems to, because no one in the coalition is interested in breaking this government and going for new elections. It doesn't serve anyone. And secondly, because as you just mentioned, he can have an alternative coalition very easily so. So the problem is not the coalition, but the devotion of the prime minister. And this devotion is very weak.
Again, I'm speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the former spokesman for Shimon Peres. And Gideon Levy writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza for over the last 25 years. And his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. So just back to Pollard then. If he's not a big deal to the Israeli people, and he's certainly not, I don't think, to the American people, but he is to the Israeli right, what are they playing with here? Because it seems to me that this sort of gets into a very uncomfortable zone if you're talking about Pollard and portraying him of having some kind of dual patriotism. He's both loyal to Israel and to the United States. And isn't that sort of playing with fire? I mean, my Jewish American friends here in the United States don't like being forced to take sides at all. It's not, you know, why should they? I mean, they're Americans first. So what are they playing with the Israeli right here?
First of all, you shouldn't think in those terms, because this is all very rational and even includes long-range considerations, while unfortunately in Israel only the very short-range considerations matter. Netanyahu had in mind a photo opportunity in the Ben-Gurion airport before Passover, when Pollard is arriving here and he invites him for the Seder, for the holiday meal, and he was sure that this will balance any kind of criticism about almost any kind of step that he will take. And maybe he is right, because the media is also now building up the Pollard issue. And maybe it would be a nice balance. The only problem is that Netanyahu has to think also about the morning after, and unfortunately I'm not sure he's doing it.
Well, it's just still incomprehensible to me that this fellow has so much ideological value on the Israeli right, and I don't understand what their message is. Is it, you know, that I thought the U.S. and Israel were incredibly close friends. Israel gets a lot of aid from the United States. Why would you want to not just condone, but in effect praise somebody that would betray America's secrets and, as far as our intelligence community is concerned, do damage to America? Why is that something that is so important to the Israeli right? I would have thought they'd be more concerned about maintaining good relations, since Israel has a fairly advantageous arrangement with the United States.
First of all, everything you said makes so much sense. But in the recent years, more and more so, you see that Israel can afford itself many, many things that no other country in the world can afford itself vis-a-vis the United States. And the United States, for reasons that I cannot explain, maybe you may, is living with it in peace. When the Minister of Defense is offending Secretary Kerry one time after the other, not only one time, twice. And, you know, as if nothing. And this is the Minister of Defense who really knows how dependent is Israel on the United States. And he afforded himself to do so. So same about Pollard. I think that Israel should have been ashamed, deeply ashamed in Pollard. But the right-wingers made out of him an idol and a national hero. And the United States, until now, didn't seem to be bothered by it, except of not releasing him. And immediately also all kind of hints that he is a victim, and even a victim of anti-Semitism in the United States. And all these created a myth, you know. To create a myth, you don't need much. And now he became a myth, mainly of the right-wingers. But the more you think about it, he's almost like Gilad Shalit here. In a few days, if this will continue, he will be perceived here like Gilad Shalit.
Sorry, I missed that bit. What was that?
I say that a few more days of this campaign, and he will be perceived in Israel like Gilad Shalit, like the prisoner of war of Israel who spent 5 years in the Hamas jail. And that's more or less the comparison in Israel. Both were heroes. But while Gilad Shalit was kidnapped and was kept in a basement in Gaza and nobody knew where he was, Jonathan Pollard is was sentenced by any law and is in jail and is not a prisoner of war, but a spy. But this is all forgotten in Israel.
Well, you know, the irony is, of course, Gideon Levy, is that he's, you know, I think he's likely to be released relatively soon anyway, isn't it? Isn't he? That my understanding.
In one and a half year time.
Right. So it's sort of like, I suppose, from Kerry's point of view, I understand the U.S. intelligence community have been dead against any early release, but it sounds like Kerry's prepared to make the deal. So what do you think is going to happen now that you've got this extra monkey wrench thrown into the process by Abbas, who's now saying, you know, if you're going to reward Israel with Pollard, you've got to reward the Palestinians?
First of all, I must to add to what you say that Kerry got already a lot of criticism by the American media, as you know. Both the New York Times and the Washington Post wrote very sharply against the release of Jonathan Pollard. So it's not only the security establishment or the intelligence establishment, it's also the media and the public opinion. Because very rightly so, they don't understand why should the United States release Pollard? What does this have to do with the peace process and what will exactly the American interest get out of it? Because we all know that this peace process leads to nowhere. We all know that nobody takes it seriously, neither Israel nor the Palestinians. Nobody of them have any kind of intention to reach a real settlement, a real peace treaty. So it's all about gaining more and more time. And then any average American can ask himself, just for gaining time, why should the United States release Pollard? What for? In any case, I guess, but that's only my personal guess, that finally there will be a deal. There will be now a few days or maybe even a few weeks, because we have time until the end of the month. There might be some kind of crisis and then there will be some kind of new proposals. And finally, I think, because it is in the interest of all the parties, finally this masquerade will continue another year and everyone will be very happy.
Well, Gideon Levy, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the former spokesman for Shimon Peres, and Gideon Levy writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. And he's been doing this for the last 25 years, and his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. And he joined us from Israel. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.